Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today because we get to talk about a really interesting new book titled Decadent Women, Yellow Book Lives, published by Reaction, which takes us through the lives, the work of some really interesting female authors. I mean, in some ways, that's almost doing them a disservice. They do so many things. Who have been perhaps unfairly forgotten. I'm very pleased that this book exists because now we get to remember them. So I'm very pleased to welcome the author, Jad Adams, to the podcast to tell us about these women and their lives. Jad, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Miranda.
Could you please start us off by introducing yourself a little bit and explaining why you decided to write this book?
Yeah, my name is Jad Adams, and I'm a historian. I'm currently concentrating on the 1890s, and this is the period in which Decadent Women is largely set. I decided to write it after I'd written a book about a poet called Ernest Dowson. He was a contemporary of Wilde and Beardsley. He was a romantic poet and wrote a lot about love. There were a lot of women in his life. But I realized when I'd completed that book, which came out in 2000, that while I'd referenced a lot of women, I actually had no women's voices in there. There were lots of women in the 1890s who were writing at the same level as men, who were getting reviewed, who were being sold at the same level as men. But it was quite clear that we had lost those women. And so I started a project, which I called Lost Girls, to establish who was writing in the 1890s and what material was still available that I could use to write a composite biography about them. And that's how Decadent Women came about.
Hmm. Thank you for giving us that sort of backstory. It's an interesting insight always into kind of what drew you into a project. So given that kind of impetus and then obviously the investigation with it, which women did you end up kind of finding out about and deciding to discuss in the book? And how did you choose who to include?
It took a long time to decide who to include. I started off with this very amorphous women of the 1890s, and I was just going to pick lots of interesting women from the 1890s. And that didn't really work. That was just a series of short biographies. That wasn't going to happen, nor would it be very commercial. And so I narrowed it down and I said, where were all these women working? Where were many of them working? And there's a preponderance of women working on the Yellow Book. There were 137 writers writing for the Yellow Book. Of those, 47, more than a third, were women. And so I said, what I'm going to do is to look just at women working for the Yellow Book. However, 47 is still an awful big number to work with for biography. And so I narrowed them down by saying, which of these women had wrote work which is enduring, which I can still read with pleasure and benefit today. So quality work. Which of these women have decent archives or at least life writing that I can refer to so I can actually do some research? And which women haven't been written about before? Because there's very little point in doing academic research if what you're doing is just looking up other people's books. So I didn't write about Vernon Lee or Pearl Craigie, for example, because I've already had books written about them. I wanted specifically to write about people who had not been written about before, so I could say, look, this is the untold story of the Women of the Yellow Book.
That is rather a lot of different pieces to juggle. I'm not surprised it took a long time to figure out. Before we get into some of the kind of specific women that you discuss in the book, could we talk about this idea of kind of the new woman in this era? What kind of did this mean? And to what extent was this a quite kind of common profile that a lot of people fit into? Or was it more sort of a made up caricature that didn't really reflect reality? What was or who was the new woman?
Well, there seemed to be women everywhere in the 1890s, very surprisingly, few more than there had been in the workplace previously. And this is because for various reasons. One of them is simply demographic. There were a million more women, a million more females than males in the UK population in the 1890s throughout the whole of that period. And this meant that women had to earn their own livings. Otherwise, they're going to be reliant on their brothers or their fathers. Their brothers would be resentful. Their fathers would die. They'd be destitute because there simply weren't enough men to go round. The Victorian expectation that a woman would be looked after by a man was utterly frustrated for these million excess females, as they were described. However, quite a lot of these women got on with it and felt that's fine. They felt unconstrained by the fact that they weren't expected to marry and weren't expected to fit into the Victorian ideal. They really embraced the freedom that going into the workplace gave them. Some of them went to be in more traditional female roles, nurses and teaching, others into new technology. They were typists or telephonists at the time when that technology was new. And a fair number of them went into the print media, into writing or illustrating.
Why was it that so many of them were going into the print industry?
The print media was massively expanding in the 1890s. The reasons are partly technological. The development of the rotary press and the relaxation of censorship and taxes on newsprint, cheaper newsprint being available, even cheaper inks. The other reasons are demographic. There was a vast increase in education in the UK, such that by 1900, so the end of the 1990s, we can say it was pretty much an entirely literate country. And this is education for everyone, particularly the 1870 Education Act had increased expectations of literacy. But as it progressed, we'd got a literate population. They had to have something to read. There's a confluence of two things. One is the population being literate. The other, technologically, it's just easier to produce magazines and newspapers very cheaply than it ever was before. And so you put these two things together, and what do you need? You need writers and illustrators to fill the pages of these journals, of these books. And that was an opening for what was called the new woman. And the new woman was someone who was very often educated, sometimes educated to university level. Places like Girton College had been running since the 1860s. And the new woman was also a recognisable character. Going out to work, she liked to dress in a more mannish style, to demonstrate her difference from her sisters. She might be smoking. That was a new woman trope. She would be likely to ride a bicycle or know people who did and go out into the country and associate with men to whom she hadn't been introduced in a drawing room setting in a home. So she would be living independently or with other women. So there are a variety of things that made this new woman, in the case of the women I'm writing about, new women writers, that made them different from women of previous decades.
Mm. Those are very helpful distinctions and context to have. So thank you for taking us through that very big question in such a kind of clear way. I think that allows us then to kind of focus on the particular magazine that many these writers kind of focus on and that you focus on in the book, literally called The Yellow Book. So what was this project? When and why did it start?
The Yellow Book was founded by a group of artists and writers who felt that art and the magazines that were published in the late Victorian period were in no way a reflection of life or art as they saw it. They felt that the Victorian ideal of art was lacking in a future, was narrow and conservative, puritanical, lacking in a future. They wanted to do something different. The other thing they're really interested in was that illustrators and artists were generally told, here's a story for a magazine, draw me a picture which will go with it. And artists really began to resent this. And they said, what we want to do is to have a magazine which will print the illustrations on their own merit and print the stories on their own merit. And while that sounds like an obvious thing for us to do, it was revolutionary for its time. So a group of people got together. Henry Harland was an American who'd made his name in New York, come over to London. Aubrey Beardsley was a brilliant young artist, and a number of other people gathered together to say, let's create a new kind of journal, and this was the Yellow Book. It was published by John Lane. Lane, again, relatively new to the publishing industry and looking to do something new, to do something different. But they are all, as you gather, these are all men, and the early circles were male, entirely male.
Well, so that's kind of what I wanted to ask about next, these circles of men, because despite the influx of women coming into these, well, I would say spaces, but I think that's part of the problem, coming into these industries, but not necessarily allowed yet into male-dominated spaces that so much important stuff actually happens in. So how did that work for these women writers literally the conversations were in places they weren't allowed into. How did that work?
You're absolutely right, Miranda, that there was the need for these women's industry, but no place where they could work in the industry. And so there's a clear contradiction. For example, the early meetings of the Yellow Book were held at the National Liberal Club, for example, and that was an all-male club. Women weren't allowed in there until 1976. So when you have a meeting of a Harland and Lane go into the club, and they see the cousin of one of them, they see a friend of another, and they meet and they chat about a list of people that they want to write for the Yellow Book, and it's an all-male list. It's a list of their friends and other people they think of as notable. So that's a severe restriction on the idea of women being involved in this project at all. However, if you're launching a magazine, you put out a prospectus. And so the Yellow Book put out a prospectus which was available through the other literary magazines saying, we're launching this book, and who wants to join in? And an army of hungry women descended on the Yellow Book effectively, or sent in their proposals for work that they wanted to put into the Yellow Book. For several reasons, John Lane, the publisher, and Henry Harland, the editor, encouraged these women. One reason was that they were comfortable around women. They didn't feel they wanted to keep women at arm's length or keep them out of the workplace. Another reason is just that as women were new to the industry and hungry for work, they were quite cheap, and so their work could be purchased quite cheaply. John Lane, with his mixture of flattery and penny pinching, managed to do quite a few very good deals with new writers. But the writers were very pleased that they were getting publication.
So, given that this is kind of a systemic problem, right? The issue, as you've talked about, of the men's spaces is not just a Yellow Book thing, right? The Yellow Book is not the only magazine being created now. The context you talked us through in terms of women being more involved and there being much more demand for print, it's not just the Yellow Book that's kind of in this. And yet you show in the book that the Yellow Book really seems to be at the forefront of engaging women writers. How and why was this the case, and what was the impact of this?
There were several places where Lane, the publisher, and Harland, the editor, encouraged women to come. Harland and his wife, Aline, another American, both would hold parties at homes every Friday evening, and they would invite both writers who were distinguished, like Henry James, who would make an appearance there, but also all their women writers. And women would be there, able to set up networks and discuss art and rub shoulders not only with famous writers, but also with John Lane, with a publisher who was able to commission their work. So that was creating a space in which women could operate. Lane himself, from his offices in Vigo Street in London's Mayfair, Lane himself would hold tea parties and invite women to come to his tea parties, which were very... This is very important because women couldn't go into pubs, so the Decadents are meeting down the road in Charing Cross Road. They're meeting at the Crown. Decadents and the realists and theatre people are meeting there. No respectable women, in quotes, no respectable women would be allowed in that place, would be seen in that place. However, respectable women could or were actually expected to be at tea parties in Mayfair. And so John Lane was creating a space for women to discuss art, to discuss their work, to meet each other. He was creating that space where there could be a development of further talent and more publishing.
Another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
What were the reactions to this? Was this sort of something that was seen as a yay, well done, or what? How did people respond?
In general, the Victorian public, the Philistine newspapers, were disgusted and horrified. They genuinely discussed these things. If we must remember the 1890s, there is no television, there's no radio, so no cinema. And so the people who are the stars, the media stars, are the people who are writing, the novelists and playwrights and the editors and the publishers. And so, for example, newspapers would mock John Lane for having so many women writers. The hearts of women throb and beat for Mr. Lane in Vigo Street is one mocking verse. There were several of these in several newspapers, and people, the readers knew who they were referring to because these were the celebrities of the time. These are the people you would gossip about. There was a certain amount of disgust that women would write so factually about sexual matters, for example, or about the marriage bond. Women were supposed to have been, women were perfectly well accepted as writers, but they were writers who wrote novels which ended with a happy marriage. And that's the end of the book. You would have, in the Yellow Book, you'd have writers like Ella Darcy, where the book, where the story starts with an unhappy marriage and gets worse. It's an attitude towards life and towards realism, an understanding of how things work. Now, this was pretty appalling to some Victorians, the more staid of them. Of course, the more open-minded and the younger people found it was tremendously exciting, and the Yellow Book was a very great success and was considered the high point of decadence in Britain. Of course, it's coming out at the same time that Oscar Wilde's plays are coming out, and so it looked as if decadence was really taking over the literary scene.
Could you tell us a bit about, I suppose, adding on to that answer, what about the women who were involved in ways that weren't just writing articles or kind of doing other aspects? You talk about in the book women working on the project behind the scenes or contributing to illustrations. What were they doing, and were they getting the same sorts of reactions?
Yes, there were certainly women illustrators. In fact, first of all, the Yellow Book, its art editor was Aubrey Beardsley. Beardsley loved drawing women, and actually one of the reasons why the Yellow Book feels like such a woman's creation is because there are so many pictures of women. However, unfortunately for women as illustrators at the time, Aubrey Beardsley didn't like employing women quite so much. So he had hardly any women illustrators on his books who appeared in the Yellow Book. However, there was a bit of a scandal over the Oscar Wilde case, and Aubrey Beardsley was kicked out, and he was cancelled in modern parlance, and that meant that there was an opening for women illustrators, and many more women came and started contributed to the Yellow Book until with one edition, I think volume 11, there are half the number of illustrators are female. So that was so that made a difference. There were also women working on the editorial side. So Ella Darcy, who was the assistant editor of the Yellow Book, worked along with Henry Harland, and another woman, Ethel Colburn Main, also worked at some time as an assistant editor to Harland, and so they were learning the task of how to put together a magazine, and in some times actually taking on the putting together of the magazine. Harland was sometimes away. He was unwell. He was going to die young from tuberculosis.
What happened then to the Yellow Book project? How long did it last? How did it end? And what impact did it have on the women involved in it, whether behind the scenes or doing illustrations or writing for it?
That's several questions. What happened? Well, let's say what happened to the Yellow Book. Mm-hmm. The Yellow Book, when it started out, it's only running from 1894 to 1897. It's appearing once a quarter. Once it came out, it was tremendously influential, and other people started copying it. And so when it first appears, it's right at the front of the race, and no one else can touch it in the field. After a couple of years, Everyone else is copying the Yellow Book and realizing what they can do with illustrations, what they can do with realism, what they can do with decadence. After a while, other people copying it, the Yellow Book is no longer unique. It's no longer quite so remarkable. Another problem with it was that because it wasn't, it declined in success. It wasn't making so much money. Originally, John Lane, the publisher, hadn't really intended that it would make money. He thought it was just going to showcase his writers, but it had gone off to be a whirlwind success on its own. And so when it stopped making money, it was a bit of a disappointment to everyone. And Harland was increasingly more unwell with his tuberculosis, so wasn't giving the book of his best. And therefore, the book just declined and died. They decided not to republish it. However, the women who'd learned from the Yellow Book continue to have, in some cases, very good careers. Netta Syrett, who is one of them, wrote some 50 books, and she's still writing in the 1940s. Ethel Colburn Main, who at one time worked as assistant editor on the Yellow Book, was again still working in the 1940s, still publishing books. So there was success. There were also some people who never recovered those early years and effectively went into a decline and never mastered the market. And Ella Darcy was one of those, a very good writer, kept writing books that she'd submit to one publisher. Once it was rejected, she'd put it in a drawer and leave it there. She just didn't have the tenacity to keep going, as you absolutely must if you're working in literature.
That's, I mean, unsurprisingly sort of a mixed outcome. You wouldn't expect sort of so many of these writers to kind of have the exact same experience. But obviously that kind of point about tenacity, given sort of the expectation society has for women at this point, unfortunately makes a lot of sense. It, to me, sort of seemed similar to kind of the next thing I'd like to ask you about, which is the idea of marriage. Given sort of what we talked about earlier of the new woman and in many ways how disruptive the kind of public perception seemed to be, and especially the new women who then went on to become writers for the Yellow Book Project, I was kind of curious about this as I was reading through the book. Like, did these writers marry? What were those marriages like? And so I was quite pleased that this is something you very much go into. So I'm wondering if you could maybe tell us a bit about that aspect.
Yes, yeah, certainly some women married, some had affairs. That wasn't at all uncommon in this group of women. Henry Nevinson was a journalist who had an affair with Evelyn Sharp. So she's a contributor to the Yellow Book, rather an important political character as well. She becomes a suffragette later on. She's having an affair with Nevinson. She can't marry him because he has a wife, and his wife is Catholic and refuses to give him a divorce. And so they can't marry until the 1930s. But she does get married in the end. But there are others. People like George Edgerton, Chevalier to Bright, that George Edgerton is her pen name. She had many different men, but finally settled on one, a guy called Golding Bright, who luckily enough was a theatre agent and so could help her in her writing for the theatre, which is one of the sort of things you need as a person on your own in the arts, is a partner who can help with these things. I think as important as the question of marriage, I mean, there's some people simply didn't marry and they lived with other women or lived on their own. And people like Netta Syrett, who never married, actually made a remark about the men writers that she knew who didn't marry and made enough money just to keep themselves, but not a wife and family. And she'd obviously seen this as a sort of a life plan, that you could do that And that's exactly what Netta Syrett did. She made enough money from her writing, sometimes two books a year, made enough money just to keep her own, to keep her life going, to live in a quite nice flat and have holidays and so on. But it's very contained. It's not what you would expect from Victorian family life with big families and a house somewhere in the country.
Which is, I think, what makes it so interesting to sort of complicate our assumptions about what it was like for women in that period.
Yes. The other matter is childbirth. Of a few of the women who wrote for the Yellow Book, E. Nesbitt famously had children, and E. Nesbitt wrote a lot about her children because she's had books written about her. I didn't write about her, but I wrote about another one called Mabel Dearmer. And Mabel had two children, one of them, the poet Geoffrey Dearmer, in fact. Mabel had two children, and she wrote books about her children. And so that was a movement from domesticity into literature. However, most of the people that I have written about either didn't have any children or had just one. And that's way below the Victorian average of five children per woman.
Again, a very interesting kind of complexity or nuance to the sort of, I suppose, statistical norm or certainly assumption that we might have. I wonder if I can ask you to kind of go back right to the beginning of this, when you said your impetus was kind of investigating the women that we didn't know as much about, that didn't have kind of the already have biographies on it. Is there anything you came across in the process of researching or writing the book that really surprised you? I mean, obviously I learned things from the book, but you being so close to all the sources, was there anything in particular that jumped out at you?
I think the life story of Gabriella Cunningham Graham absolutely amazed me. And I'm still fascinated by this woman. She appears as a writer in her own right, contributor to the Yellow Book. She wrote a very important biography of St. Teresa. She's a platform speaker, a socialist. She travels all over the country and abroad, speaking at places like May Day demonstrations. She's in the thick of it. She's right there within radical politics, right at the edge. She's married to Robert Cunningham Graham, who's an MP and the founder of the Scottish National Party, and so she's got all this, and her backstory is that she was the daughter of a Chilean, so brought up partly in Chile, then brought up in France. She talks with this French-Spanish accent, very peculiar accent, personal to herself, and she's called Gabriella. Gabriella de la Belmondier is the title. It's all nonsense. Not the achievements, the personal achievements, standing on the platform, writing the books, that's true. But the name and the accent and the antecedents are all rubbish. It's an entirely fictitious personality. She was actually a doctor's daughter from Yorkshire called Caroline Horsfall. And she ran away when she was 16 and went to go on the stage. And then we lose her for a bit, and then she emerges sometime later with this exotic pedigree and this assumed accent and so on. She's just a wonderful character, and her secret wasn't revealed during her lifetime or indeed until this century. In fact, the Times newspaper was still making a mistake over it in 2006. So I was really pleased to have made the acquaintance of Gabriella Cunningham Graham.
I'm so glad you told us that one. It was definitely quite interesting to read about her in the book. So thank you for sharing that, obviously, quite concise version of her life. Any listeners who want to learn more, of course, the book has more details, but thank you for giving us that sort of insight. If I can ask, as a final question, the book obviously is pretty new and took rather a lot of work to put together. But now that it's done, is there anything you might have your eye on to work on next?
I'm now working on my diaries. I've got several million words worth of diaries going back to 1990, and they're all in longhand, and I'm transcribing them via voice recognition software, so that I can give them to archives and they'll be searchable. So we will have future generations will have a diary of someone from 1890 to the present day. So that's pretty much the end of the Cold War to the beginning of World War III.
Hmm. All right. Well, that sounds like quite an interesting project. Best of luck with that. But of course, while you're off working on that next piece, listeners can read the book titled Decadent Women, Yellow Book Lives, published by Reaction, that we've been discussing. Jad, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Miranda.